By this I mean, so you know the symmetries of your problem, and you try to use the symmetries to simplify your dynamic. Yes?
So when you say additional space time symmetries, they're not symmetries of space time, are they?
Well, they're space time transformations, that's what I mean.
Right, but you know, for example, when we are talking about quantum theory on a flat space time, you know, we are, because Poincare symmetries are symmetry of Minkowski space, right?
Yes.
So these extra symmetries, would they be also symmetries of Minkowski space?
They're not isometries of Minkowski space. They're conformal isometries of Minkowski space. Yeah, we're going to discuss this in a lot of detail now. Yeah, they're not isometries. They're conformal symmetries. They're conformal isometries. So when you have a physical problem in classical mechanics or quantum mechanics, and you know the symmetries, like you have rotational invariants, first, when you write the Schrödinger equation or even the particle in a potential, the first thing that you do is you write the kinematics. And for example, if you have a radial potential, without, before you start doing any work, naively, if you didn't know any better, you said you have to solve a third a differential equation for, say, the three special coordinates. But if you have rotational invariants, you know essentially that you only reduce the problem to an equation for the radial direction. Okay, so that's being clever about symmetries. If you don't know about symmetries, you would write horrible differential equations and we wouldn't get your head out of it. So what we're going to do now is to use symmetries as cleverly as we can, so that we are left with the analog of the first order differential equation for the radial coordinate. Okay. So, and once it is done to exhaustion, then we go to the actual dynamics. And the beautiful thing about a conformal field theories is that essentially the dynamics, which means, in this context, means the set of correlation functions of the theory, will be at least conceptually determined by imposing consistency conditions. Consistency conditions of the correlation functions will essentially give you an infinite set of equations that in principle solve them. Okay. That doesn't mean that we know how to solve these equations in general, but for example, in two dimensions, we know how to solve them completely analytically, these equations. So this is an example in which, essentially by pure thought, you say, okay, I have a set of observables and some consistency conditions that you will understand the physics behind it. That solves the theory completely. There is no Lagrangian, there are no coupling constants, you just solve the theory on the nose, okay? That's what we're aiming to do, okay? So, but today, since this is a cookbook recipe, where you have to make the dough and then the oven, so we're gonna start with the kinematics. So let's do kinematics. And actually, before doing kinematics, so we're doing quantum field theory, but just like, Poincaré transformations is something you can describe just in purely in geometry, and then you can ask how that geometry, those transformations are implemented in quantum field theory. We will do the same thing with conformal transformations. So first we're going to just talk about geometry. What is the geometry of conformal transformations? And then tomorrow, or whenever it is, we will explain how the geometry of conformal transformations is implemented on quantum fields. Okay, so essentially the goal that I want to do is today, one of the goals I want to derive today is to derive the complete set of conformal transformations in Minkowski space. Okay? And we will see that it's a finite dimensional set of transformations. And okay, so maybe for that I should make a couple of points that I believe they're familiar, but I should probably say it. So whenever you have a transformation that acts on a physical system, those transformations form a group, okay? Because if you have a transformation and it's invertible, which it has an inverse, and then if you have two transformations, you can concatenate them and you get another transformation and so on. So the conformal transformations in general, any physical transformation, any collection of conformal of transformations, generate a group, define a group. Group G. Okay. So you're familiar with the group of rotations. You're familiar with the Poincaré group, and so on and so forth. So one of the things I want to do today is describe what is the group of conformal transformations. And another thing that I believe is also familiar in some language, is that you can, when you implement a transformation, you can ask for a subset of the transformations that are close to the identity. Okay, so these are kind of small transformations. Okay, and then you know that the collection of transformations that are close to the identity for any type of transformation. This is important. That okay. So what I'm saying now is it's true for continuous transformations. As opposed to discrete transformations like parity. Parity is a discrete transformation, right? It's a Z2 transformation. There is no continuous parameter that parameterizes a parity transformation. So for continuous transformations, the small transformations or the small transformations, namely those that are connected to the identity, which means that a given element is mapped to a nearby group element, are completely encoded by a Lie algebra. And here I want to emphasize the word continuous, okay? Which is, this is some object that is, has a collection of generators, TA, TB, that obey this famous equation, which is the Lie algebra equation, where F, A, B, C are the structure constants of the Lie algebra that satisfy the Jacobi identity. Are these two statements known to a certain degree for you? I can elaborate more on them, but it's probably not point. So in this lecture, what I want to do is first derive the Lie algebra. So I said that any transformation generates a group. The infinitesimal ones generate a Lie algebra. We want to discover what the Lie algebra of conformal transformation is. Okay? Good. Okay, so let's start. So let's discuss conformal transformations. So there are various ways of physically describing what a conformal transformation is. One possibility are these are transformations that have the property that they preserve angles between vectors. Or they preserve the Lie cones. So this means that, so this is essentially the definition of what a conformal transformation is. Notice that what's important here is that it preserves angles, but not necessarily distances, okay? I already discussed at length yesterday an example of a transformation that preserves angles but not distances, the scale transformation. Okay? Now, how do we write this in these words into mathematical equations? So what we want to do is we have our space-time. And let's be in this lecture, and throughout most of the lectures, I'll be a bit cavalier between being Euclidean and Lorentzian signature. You can weak rotate from one to the other. So depending on what crosses my brain, I will use one or the other. But for this lecture, let me try to think of Lorentzian signature. So this is supposed to be Minkowski space. So Minkowski space in these space-time dimensions. And what we're looking is at transformations that map a point x to a point x tilde. Okay. And essentially, this transformation, so this will map x mu. So mu runs over all the Minkowski spacetime coordinates. Will map x mu to x tilde as a function of x. So this, in general, is a nonlinear transformation that of x. X tilde is a nonlinear function of x. Okay. And the fact that it preserves angles and it preserves the Lie cones can be written as the statement that the length element is so that this space and transformation preserves the Lie element up to a factor. So it's isotropic, so it doesn't change angles, but it can change the overall length scale. And we write this as so this is how you write in formulas what it means. What is the physical meaning of these words, okay? Where omega x, as of now, is an arbitrary function of space-time, arbitrary function of space-time coordinates. But as we will see in a moment, naively we say, okay, this is an arbitrary function. Yes.
Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
In that formula, are we actually transforming the infinitesimal dx's or the metric?
You can do one or the other, never both. Okay. Because doing both is not doing anything. This is a very, yeah. I will write a more explicit equation of which ones I'm transforming. I mean, what Tibra is referring to is that if I give you a metric, ds squared, g mu nu, dx mu, dx nu, and you make a coordinate transformation, and you change both g, mu nu, and dx mu, of course that's invariant. But we are people living in a fixed Minkowski space, and what we're doing is we're changing the coordinates. The Minkowski metric is kept the same. Okay. So now I'm going to write in equations what this means. So in order to maybe help emphasize this, so what is this in equations? This in equations means that eta rho sigma, this is the Minkowski metric, okay? D tilde x rho, d tilde x sigma equals e to the 2 omega x eta mu nu dx mu dx nu. That's what a conformal transformation is. Now, we can try to work with this a bit more by writing this as something that looks more like a differential equation. This can be alternatively written as, or something that looks more familiar to Poincaré transformations. And this is something that you would have been familiar if this was not here. If this was one, this would be a Poincaré transformation. Okay. So this is the equation that we are now instructed to analyze and study and solve for. Okay. Now, before we do any monkey business, the first thing to say is that actually omega is not an independent function, right? Omega is determined by the choice of the transformation. So can someone tell me what is the relation between this omega and x tilde? Yeah, so you can take the determinant of this equation. This is a two-way, a matrix, right? So you can take the determinant on both sides. And if I know how to take the determinant, it tells you that the determinant of this thingy square, right? Because there are two factors here. Equals, now this is a diagonal matrix, right? So the determinant of the diagonal matrix is the product of its eigenvalue. So I'll get e to the 2d omega x. Okay? So omega x, e to the omega x is, so this I'll, so I'll keep writing that everywhere. I'll use this notation for the determinant of the Jacobian of the transformation. Okay, so is e is delta x tilde delta x 1 over d. Okay. Okay. Now, as of now, x tilde is a nonlinear function, arbitrary nonlinear function of x, but we'll see that actually that's not true. Now, let me give you some intuition of what this equation is telling us, what a conformal transformation is. So now let me do the following thing. Let me stare at this equation and try to bring it to something that we're familiar with. It's always good to go back to things you're familiar, so at least you have the illusion that you understand what you're doing. So one thing you can do is you can bring this guy to the other side, okay? If I bring this guy to the other side, then it will look like a Lorentz transform, like a Poincaré transformation, right? So let me define the matrix eta, sorry, R rho mu. What is this? So mu, and then I distribute these guys half in half, okay? That's why I put the factor of two there. So I get e to the minus omega x. So now that I've done that, I say, aha, I know what this is. This is the following. So I'm going to write it as a matrix equation, not to put all the indices, but so this looks, if I use this definition in this equation, I get that R satisfies the following equation. R transpose eta R eta, okay? But this is precisely the definition of a Lorentz transformation. Poincaré transformation, sorry. Because a Poincaré transformation is the transformation that preserves the Lorentz metric. Okay. So that tells us immediately, but now the point is that this guy is a local function of x. Okay, it's not a constant Lorentz transformation, it's an arbitrary function of x. So that means that the conformal transformations are locally, so conformal transformations. So which are these things, are locally a local Lorentz transformation. Times a scale transformation, a local scale transformation. Times local and that's good because I mean we went from something that was abstract nonsense, you know, looks complicated. We all have an intuition about what a Lorentz transformation is, about what a scale transformation is. The subtlety here is that the transformation depends on the space-time point that you're at. Okay. So it's not a homogeneous Lorentz transformation or a homogeneous scale transformation, it's space-time dependent. Okay, good. So now let's study this equation in more detail. So I already said here that transformations form a group, and the transformations that are connected to the identity, or the small transformations, are parametrized Lie algebra. So now the next goal in this lecture is to understand what the algebra of conformal transformations is. So now let's look at infinitesimal transformations. So these are transformations that map a space-time point to a nearby space-time point. And the way we write this in equations is that you say that x tilde of mu, so the conformal transformation is a map that maps x mu to x tilde of mu. But now x tilde of mu, since it's a small transformation, is very close to x mu plus a little bit. This zeta mu of x is, you can think of it as small. Okay. And first we're going to study, this thing is going against gravity. And so we'll study this first. And this is important because just as in life, you can get very far by doing one step at a time. So if you understand the small steps first, you can get everywhere, essentially. So that's why we studied this first. And that will be, there may be global issues that one has to worry about, but let's first understand the small steps. Okay, and this gadget, so this zeta mu is a space-time vector field. More precisely, the standby vector field is a vector zeta, which has components zeta mu. So we want to solve for the vector field zeta mu that obey this, wait, I lost the equation, I think it's here, that solve this equation. By the way, this equation is called the, well, okay, I will write the infinitesimal equation. Okay, so now what we have to do is, this is like high school, not even high school, maybe high school, I don't know. Just expand this equation. Okay, so let's expand it. By the way, the details of all of these are in the notes, so I may skip at some points small details because it's pointless for me to do kind of arithmetic in the blackboard of the. But okay, so let me just do a little bit of arithmetic. So I'm just expanding this equation, okay? Delta nu sigma plus then nu sigma. And this is dx tilde, dx to the, oh, okay. Yeah, so, okay, I'll do one more step. I'm being nice today. Okay, and this is to what power? Yeah, you have to check me, but it's very easy to screw things up in the blackboard like this, but okay. So all I did is evaluate the conformal transformation equation under a small coordinate transformation. But now this is, I also have to make this small. And now I believe no one will kill me if I tell you that this equation is nothing but 1 plus 2 over d, the divergence of the vector field. Is this something that looks completely obnoxious, or you would know how to derive? You can derive this by the following. So this follows from two lines of proving that the determinant of a matrix is the exponential of the trace of the logarithm of the matrix. Okay. So if you plug in this into here, you're going to get this. Okay. So now let's compare this equation. Let's look at this equation in more detail. Now, to leading order, so let's first look at the order of zeta to the zero. Remember, zeta is a small quantity, and we're solving for zeta. So at order zero, you just get this times this times this equals 1 times this. So it tells you a triviality. It tells you that eta mu nu equals eta mu nu. Okay? So now, what is the equation at order zeta? Now you get something interesting. What you get is that d mu, sorry. You get that d mu zeta nu plus d nu zeta mu equals, and now I look at the leading order at the linear term here on the right hand side, is 2 over the space time dimension eta mu nu, the divergence of the vector field. I just have picked up the linear terms here, okay? So this with this, and this with this. And the linear term on the right-hand side is this, okay? And this equation is the conformal killing vector equation. Now, why do we use this obnoxious name? Because if the right-hand side here, if this had been 1, in this equation, this would have been 0. And that's what, and that is the killing vector equation. Okay. But now, since we have some scale factor floating around, it's called the conformal killing vector equation. Good. So now this is the equation that we somehow have to figure out how to solve. Okay? I'm giving up on gravity. Okay. So maybe before that, again. You can do whatever you want, yeah. Actually, sometimes I try that if
it doesn't have the.
I put a battery or something. No, it doesn't. Okay. So let's first solve the equation. Sorry. So if e to the 2 omega is 1, then we know that what we get are the Poincaré transformations, right? That actually preserve the length, the angles, but also the lengths. Then we get Poincaré. And then the equation that we have to solve, let me just write it. Now, if you do the same linearization as I did before here, I think you accept that you get this equation. Okay. Now, something that you can do, I'm trying to build an intuition for what's going for conformal transformation, something that follows from this equation, essentially by taking a derivative with respect to rho of this equation. Let's take a derivative with respect to rho of this equation. You get d rho d mu zeta nu plus d rho nu zeta mu. Now let's take this equation and write the same equation with mu and nu, so with mu and rho exchanged. So I just write this equation with rho and mu exchanged. Well, partial derivatives famously commute. So I get z nu, but here I get something different. Zeta, I'm already making a mess. Okay, so zero. And now I'll write the same equation here with rho and nu swap. So I get nu mu zeta rho plus, what did I say? I'm replacing nu with rho, right? So this doesn't change. And now I take this equation minus this equation. And let's see if I made a mess or not. So this guy cancels this guy, right? And this guy cancels this guy. And these two guys are the same. So what do I get? What I get, this implies that infinitesimal Poincaré transformation is generated by a vector field that obeys this equation. Okay, let me write it more explicitly. What does this tell us? That the infinitesimal vector field is at most a linear function of x, because the second derivative with respect to x, arbitrary second derivative with respect to x, vanishes. Okay, and that matches with things that you know, because you know that an infinitesimal Lorentz Poincaré transformation is given by a parameter, which is a constant. This is the translation transformation, plus a local Lorentz transformation, which is parameterized by this infinitesimal vector field. It's linear in x. Okay? And you saw that to do this, it was like just being silly, nothing very deep. Okay? Now we can do a similar game. It's slightly more involved, but it's just like the next page in Sudoku games, just one a little bit more. And I will not go through the details of that in the lecture. They're very carefully spelled out in the notes. Now we can do essentially the same game to prove. I want to prove something about the property of zeta. Okay, right now zeta is an arbitrary function of x. So from that equation and taking derivatives and, you know, doing the relabelings and blah blah blah, what you can prove is the following: is that psi mu is a conformal. If zeta mu is a conformal Killing vector, so CKW is a solution of the conformal Killing equation, then zeta satisfies the following equation. Okay. Mu, nu, rho, sigma. So whereas Poincaré transformations, the infinitesimal vector field was annihilated by two derivatives, for conformal conformal transformations, the infinitesimal vector field is killed by three derivatives. Okay, so this immediately tells you something very powerful. It tells us that the set of conformal transformations is finite dimensional, because the most general vector field. This guy will be the most general vector field, which is a polynomial to degree 2 in the coordinates. That's obviously finite dimensional, because we're a d-dimensional Minkowski space. You can write the most general polynomial that's quadratic in the axis, that's finite dimensional. Okay. Okay. There is one exception. Yes?
I was just going to say that's only true in more than two dimensions,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so that was what I was going to say, yes. So in d equals 2, since you said it, and now my contract says that I have to say it, so If I plug d equals 2 here, something special happens. First of all, this factor is 1, right? And now I can look at this equation. Let's look at that equation for mu equals nu equals 1. It tells you that d1 zeta 1 twice equals d1 zeta 1 plus d2 zeta 2, OK? So I can kill one factor of d zeta 1 with the one here, and you end up getting d1 zeta 1 equals d2 zeta 2. OK? If I choose now mu equals 1 and nu equals 0, equals 2, sorry, I get that. Now the right-hand side vanishes, right? Because the Minkowski metric only has diagonal components. So the right-hand side will be 0. And what I'm going to get is that d1 zeta 2 equals minus d2 zeta 1. And these equations have a name. So someone knows what the names are? The Cauchy-Riemann equations, yeah. And the most general solution of the Cauchy-Riemann equations is a holomorphic function. So if I write if I let z be x1 plus ix2, OK, now I say cheated a little bit. I went to Euclidean signature, but forgive me. I mean, you can say the exact same thing about Lorentzian signature. Then these equations are just dz var of zeta equals 0. And that's just the equation that zeta is an arbitrary holomorphic function. Okay. So that's why, and the collection of holomorphic functions is infinite dimensional. Of course, the space of holomorphic functions that do not have singularities anywhere in the compactified in flat space is finite dimensional. But you can have arbitrary conformal transformations that have a singularity, say, at the origin or at infinity. Yes.
So for Lorentzian transformations, we see it's at most linear, and for conformal, we see it's at most quadratic. Do you get more interesting things at most quartic, at most
quartic? Not that I know of. As I said, the conformal transformations are kind of, they are is the final stop in a train of what's the most possible, the most general transformation. I mean, there are horrible things called W transformations that we shouldn't talk about, but actually the geometry of those transformations is, even up to this day, not completely clear. So maybe I will leave it as a tutorial to figure it out. Yeah. Okay. So indeed, it's finite dimensional. For d bigger than 2, and infinite dimensional for d equals 2. Okay, so now I'll just write down the most. So what you do is you write down the most general quadratic polynomial in x, and plug it back into the equation, and then we have the most general solution. OK, so what is it? So the most general solution is this. So a mu plus, of course, this guy had to be there, because we already know that a Poincaré transformation is a particular instance of a conformal transformation. Now we have something else that can be linear in x. And actually, that's the one that we described at length yesterday, is lambda x mu. What does this transformation do? It sends x mu to x mu plus lambda x mu, right? Which is nothing but 1 plus lambda x mu, right? So that's an infinitesimal scale transformation. And now we have to look at the kind of the more subtle because it's nonlinear. We have some intuition about linear things, right? For nonlinear things, you don't have much of an intuition, even though there is a way of making more intuitive by embedding this in a higher dimensional space. We may or may not talk about this. So this is the most general solution of that equation. And I'm parameterizing the various terms cleverly by these parameters, A, omega, lambda, and B. Okay, so now let's count. Yes.
So is omega anti-symmetric?
Yes, and that follows from plugging it back into the equation. Yeah.
Sorry, another question.
Yes.
Why can't you have a term that's like x mu, x nu contracted?
Yeah, so that's a good exercise. So write the most general thing and plug it back into that equation, and you will see that not all structures are really allowed. They're, just like here, if you plug it here, you would have thought that I could have a symmetric omega mu, but that's killed by the Lorentz equation. So now let's count parameters. So first of all, this guy is associated to translations. So how many parameters are going to be in these space-time dimensions? D. Now, how many of those are there? How many Lorentz transformations? D minus 1 over 2. OK. Well, how about this one? You look puzzled. Sorry, am I screwing this up? No, I think it's correct. So it's the most general anti-symmetric D by D matrix. Yeah. Lambda is just 1. And V is, again, just a D-dimensional vector, so I have D. By the way, so I guess I should give names. So this guy will be associated. So remember that I said that an infinitesimal transformation, the vector fields generate a Lie algebra. And we can, remember I talked about those TA guys. So I'm going to write the TAs associated to each of the independent vector fields. So of course, to A mu, we associate P mu, which are the usual translations. To omega mu nu, we associate Lorentz transformations. We call M mu nu. To lambda, this is a horrible problem, but I don't know what to do about it. We call it D, not to be confused with the space-time dimension. That's called dilatation, for obvious reasons. And this B mu, we associate a generator that we call K mu, and that has an inspiring name of a special conformal transformation. Soon, I will give you an intuition of what I think you have an intuition about the first three. Maybe not so much of the last two and the last one, but I'll tell you how to think about it. Okay, so that means that the total, if you add now these numbers, it means that the Lie algebra in these space-time dimensions of conformal transformations is this plus this plus this plus this, which is d plus 2 times d plus 1 divided by 2. Algebra, dimensional. Conformal algebra. So the algebra of conformal transformations, we're going to call the conformal algebra, just like the Poincaré transformations, we generate the conformal the Poincaré algebra. OK. What do I want to tell you? Okay, so now I just told you what the multinational vector field is. Now we want to find out what the actual algebra is. So how do you do that? The way we do that is by taking commutators, right? That's how you compute Lie algebras. The structure constants of the Lie algebra, you take the commutators between the various generators. Okay. And the way you do it is that if I give you one vector field, You can do it just using geometry, okay? So I give you one vector field, zeta mu 1. I give you another vector field, zeta mu 2. Because this forms the Lie algebra, we know that the commutator. Sorry. So let me write. I'm writing the full vector field, okay? So I have a vector field, zeta 1, that generates one transformation. I have another vector field zeta 2 that generates another transformation. We know that the Lie bracket will be another conformal vector, conformal Killing vector. Okay? And from that, if we decompose psi in this way, we can compute the commutators of all the various Lie algebra generators. So we can compute the commutator of P mu with M mu, P mu with D, blah, blah, blah. Okay? So let me just write down the commutators. And maybe some of these I think you may do in the tutorial or exercise, whatever the name is called. So let me write down the ones that you already know. So since this is not kind of, this is like I'm not talking to myself, I will ask for advice. So if I take the commutator of two Lorentz transformations, what will I get here on the right-hand side? Lots of etas. Are you sure? Lots of etas? Well, you get one, not... I don't know what you mean by lots. You get lots of terms, but not lots of etas. Okay, so you get one, eta, mu, rho, m, nu, sigma, right? And now what you do is you write terms so that the right-hand side is antisymmetric under mu nu and under rho sigma. So let me try to do it without making a mess. It's non-trivial. Okay, so antisymmetric means, so minus mu rho mu sigma. And I want to take this term and I want to make it antisymmetric and under rho mu. So mu sigma m mu rho plus eta mu sigma mu rho. Okay? Now, can someone tell me what the commutator of Lorentz transformations with translations is? What do you get on the right hand side? Is it zero?
No.
Is it non-zero? Yes, okay, so what is it?
Eta mu rho. Ah, minus.
Well, no, minus depends a bit on conventions, but yeah, no, you get eta mu
rho
p nu, and then again, I have to antisymmetrize in mu nu, so I have to get eta nu rho p mu. Okay, so this you know, this is just the Poincaré algebra. And actually, if you've never done this exercise, you can see that you can obtain these commutators by just taking these vector fields and computing the Lie brackets. Okay. So now let me write down the other ones. So this is something that, also, again, by contract, I have to do once. So I'll write the commutators of all the conformal generators with each other. So this will define the Lie algebra of conformal transformations, the conformal algebra. So can someone guess just from, it's not a guess, I mean, can someone tell me what do you expect the commutator of Lorentz transformation with the special conformal transformations to be? Guessing in physics is like 80% of the work. I don't know, what do you have to work with? You have the Lorentz metric and you have the Lie algebra generators. What can you write down on the right-hand side?
Something like with the translations?
Well, that would be a good guess, but it would be a wrong guess, unfortunately. But no, exactly, the reason it's not a good guess. I mean, actually, this equation is one way to geometrically understand this equation is the statement that P rho is a Lorentz vector, right? So that means that if I apply a Lorentz transformation to a vector, I get back the same vector. Now this guy is a vector, right? Has a rho index. So if I apply a Lorentz transformation to the vector, the fact that it's a vector tells you that the right hand side I should get the same guy back. So it's going to be it's essentially the same as this one. So I'm going to get eta mu rho k nu minus eta nu sigma nu rho k mu. And you can check again by doing the Lie bracket of this vector field with this vector field. Sorry, with this vector field. So this is just a statement that k mu, by the way I wrote it, is a vector. Space-time vector. OK, now let's go to the interesting ones. So now I look at the commutator of dilatations with translations, you get this. I think you're going to do this in some exercise. So it's completely straightforward. Now, does this thing here remind you of something that you've seen before? Yes, more or less. So it's like, it tells you that if you think of D as a Hamiltonian, it tells you that P is a lowering operator, or one is a raising operator and the other one is a lowering operator. Okay? And this will be very important for us because when we study conformal field theories, we will be most interested in the spectrum of this operator, the dilatation operator. Because this is the spectrum of this operator is what determines the correlation, the power law behavior of the correlation function. But this already tells you that when we study the representation theory of the conformal algebra, we'll have a raising operator and a lowering operator. Just like when you study, say, IZ2 angular momentum, you have J3, J1, J2, and J3. You define J plus and J minus. And J plus is like a raising operator, and J minus is a lowering operator. And that's how you build the representations. For the conformal algebra, it will be the same. And one of them will be a lowering operator, the other one will be a raising operator. And now, the really exciting one will be P mu with K nu. We really only have 10 minutes left, that's crazy. Okay, so the answer is this. So you get the dilatation operator back plus local Lorentz, plus Lorentz transformation. Okay, so this is the, so all this enchilada is the conformal algebra. So we completed the task of understanding the infinitesimally algebra of conformal transformations. Okay. So this complete. And now, in order to constrain the physics, we will have to understand better the representation theory of the conformal algebra. Okay. Let's see what I want to say now. Okay. At this point, this may still look like a complete abstract nonsense collection of commutators that you don't know what we're talking about. Now, the thing that will be remarkable is that by suitable rewriting of the generators, we will see that actually the conformal algebra is the algebra that actually you know, in some sense. Or it's a slight generalization of a Lie algebra that you know very well. Already, one hint is the dimension. You know of some Lie algebra that has this dimension. Are we going to derive what it is? Okay. So now let me do something, the following thing. Let me define a new index that extends space-time by 2. So let me call it a combined index capital M, where mu went from a z, from over the space-time dimensions, right? So now let me define an index mu that is, sorry, xm, that is going to be x mu, and then xd, and xd plus 1. So I extend, if you wish, space-time by 2 additional coordinates. Okay. These are our, this parameterized Minkowski, if you wish, and these are additional coordinates. Now I define the following. This is just a declaration, and then you have to check something. Let me define L mu nu, identify L mu nu with M mu nu, the Lorentz rotations. L d d plus 1 with d. Oh, okay, this, if I remember, I'll try to put a hat. This d is an operator, okay? And then L mu d is going to be 1 half translations plus conformal special conformal transformations, and L mu d plus 1 is 1 half p mu minus k mu. So this is an antisymmetric d plus 2. So Lmn is an antisymmetric d plus 2 dimensional matrix. So I indeed have given all the entries. I have parameterized this arbitrary d plus two dimensional matrix, and I have identified them with the conformal generators. Okay. Now what you can do is prove, given this collection of commutators, that indeed Lmn Lpq is eta, okay, so eta hat, I'll be careful, m p l and q, and I'm not going to bother to write the other three terms, which are fixed by antisymmetry, okay? Where eta hat is a Minkowski metric with the following signature. So the diagonal metric, okay, so I can write it like this. It's minus plus, plus, plus. This runs over the space-time indices. So this has to do with the mu index. And now I have to tell you what the signature for the xd plus 1 entry is. And the signature, using those commutators and being careful, you find that the signature is plus, minus, OK? So, first of all, what does this Lie algebra look like? Looks like a Lie algebra of Lorentz transformations, right? Because this is the Lie algebra, essentially, is a transformation that preserves a Lorentz kind of a Minkowski-like metric. But now the subtlety is that, first of all, we are in d plus two dimensions, because m and n run over d plus two dimensions. But now the signature of that Minkowski metric has two minus signs and the rest plus signs, okay? So that means that this implies that the conformal algebra is SO, that's what Lorentz algebra is, SO, two, because I have two negative signs, comma D. And now, what is the dimension of this guy? It's precisely this guy. But now we did much better. We identified the conformal algebra with something that you have some intuition about, just some Lorentz transform, if you wish, some Lorentz transformation that acts on some higher dimensional space. And actually, that point of view is extremely useful. We may not develop it too much in this course, but it's very powerful because it gives some intuition about these nonlinear transformations. Because, so they're nonlinear in Minkowski space, but the transformations become linear when you act on this higher dimensional d plus two dimensional space. Okay? But that maybe for now would take us too far afield. Any questions about this? So essentially what we have identified is the conformal algebra that in the view, in the one in which the geometry is manifest, looks unintuitive, is nothing but a Lie algebra that's well known to mathematicians and to also physicists. Just the Lorentz algebra with some cookie signature. Okay. Any questions about this? Yes. Oh, you have a comment or
interpretation to this very suggestive, like it seems like this should have some geometry.
It has. And you're forcing me to go into that. So No. Actually, there are two things I said. So remember, yesterday I drew the can of soup. So at least one something I can say is that SO2,D, which is the this was the step zero of the ADS-CFT correspondence, in the sense that the symmetries of a CFT in D dimensions is SO2,D, and the isometries of ADS-D plus one is exactly the same. Okay, so this was kind of the symmetries of the two theories match. Of course, this doesn't mean that the theories are the same, but this is one indication. There is a way, which is what Dibra is referring to, there is a way of, if you wish, embedding Minkowski space into a higher dimensional space in which these transformations act linearly. And we may or may not do that later in the course, depending on time and space and all of that. There are two times, though. I mean, okay. Okay. I shouldn't say that. And actually, this higher dimensional space is very closely related to something that you may have heard, which is called twister space. Okay. Good. So far we have discussed infinitesimal transformations. Now let's discuss a very important a conformal transformation that's not infinitesimal. Just like there are important Poincaré transformations that are not infinitesimal, like time reversal or time reversal and parity. Okay. So now let's look at an important conformal transformation. Not connected to identity. Okay, so it maps a point here to far away. So let me just write what the transformation is, and you can check that it's a conformal transformation. It's a transformation that maps x mu to x mu divided by x squared. Clearly, the origin is mapped very far away, right? So it's not an infinitesimal transformation. And that's actually, to make this precise sense of this, you have to compactify Minkowski space so that this transformation is well defined on compactified Minkowski space. Just like when you study that sometimes we compactify R2 into the Riemann sphere by adding a point at infinity, there is a similar notion of that for Minkowski space. Okay, so the first thing I want you to check is it is a conformal transformation. And I want you to compute what is the associated e to the 2 omega x associated to this conformal transformation. Two, it maps the transformation that maps the unit ball, the inside of the unit ball, to outside. So that's why it maps something. Yeah, so it's not infinitesimal in any way. Well, two, that this one is obvious, the Z2 transformation. So it's a discrete transformation. There's no continuous parameter associated to it, unlike the other ones. So it's a Z2 transformation. That's obvious. Do this twice and you get back to the same point. And four, which is very important, it reverses orientation of space-time. Is there another transformation that you know that changes the orientation of space-time? Parity, yeah. So actually, inversion is very closely related to parity. Actually, we can make this very rigorous. And the way you can prove that is precisely you write the volume element in flat space, and you see that under conformal transformation, it will pick a sign. The sign will change, so it changes the orientation. OK, now, a statement. The group of conformal transformations is obtained by combining translations with inversion. Is the statement at least clear? So now let me try to flesh it out a little bit. So now, let me now explain why, at least, motivate why. Exactly. So remember, before we were talking about the Lie algebra of conformal transformations, they're the ones that are infinitesimal. Now, the entire set of all conformal transformations, including things like parity, time reversal, blah, 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 can be obtained by just combining these two. Okay? And why is that the case? You can prove that if you take I, if you do an inversion, a translation followed by an inversion, you get the special conformal transformation. So let me just show you this quickly, and then you can do the rest. So I'll probably make a mess, but whatever. So this is the first step, an inversion. Now let me add a translation by a quantity a mu. You get this, right? I just added a mu. Now invert again. If I invert again, I'm going to get x mu divided by x squared plus a mu divided by this horrible thing square. And if you write this down, you get x mu plus a mu x squared divided by let me do it in more steps because I'm confusing myself. So let me pull out an x squared. So I get x mu plus a mu x squared, right? I haven't done anything. And here I pull a 1 over x squared. I see. So I think I can write this. OK, I can write it like this, as x mu plus I need some help. And this is just a dot x, right? Wait. I feel I'm doing something. Sorry? Like this? Oh, this sounds, no, this is not going to be right. Can I see my note 1 second? Sorry. Okay, so no, this. Yeah. Okay. So I think what I have written here, let's check it's correct. It's 1 plus a squared x squared plus 2 a dot x. I think that's correct. So if I square this thing, you get this, right? And now notice that if I do an infinitesimal transformation, so that a mu is small, I get x mu plus a mu x squared minus 2 x mu, oh, I'm making a mess here, a dot x, okay? Which was precisely the infinitesimal conformal transformation. Anyway, so you can do the same thing with all the other ones. And that means that if I have translations and I use inversions, I get for free k. Okay, but now if I look at the commutator of k with p, I get dilatations. Okay, so I'm almost there. I can get dilatations and Lorentz transformation, so I get everything. Okay. Good. So in fact, can I say more about this? So I wanted to give you an intuition about what a special conformal transformation is. And now you see that it's something simple. It's an inversion that you have some feeling for, that you know it maps the unit sphere, the unit ball to outside the unit ball, just translation and then the same operation back. So now if we want to study the constraints of conformal symmetry in a quantum field theory, we will make very good use of inversions, because in some sense, using the things that we already know plus inversions generates the whole conformal transformations in the dimension. Okay? And that's the thing that is this a good place to stop? Of course, there are always more things one can say, and there are more things that are said in the lecture notes. In the lecture notes, I explain in more detail what is the global structure of the conformal group in terms of what are the connected components and disconnected components. There is a similar story to Lorentz, where there is a connected component and then parity and time translation. Here it's similar. You have the connected component, which is under which all CFTs are invariant, and then you have disconnected components under which CFTs may or may not be invariant. Okay? So we'll continue. I guess it's tomorrow, right? Yeah, tomorrow. Yeah.